You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. For many South Africans, America's Black Lives Matter movement is a reminder of their own history, of nearly 50 years of systemic racial oppression called apartheid.
In South Africa, native protest flared against apartheid and passport laws. 100 died when police fired on demonstrators at Sharpeville.
Under apartheid, South Africa's white leaders used the police as an important instrument of control to enforce a bewildering, tightening web of laws that bound black lives.
There are 13 million black South Africans living in a society dominated by 3 million white South Africans.
Laws made white people officially superior, and the large black majority faced discrimination in every aspect of their lives.
By the 1980s, footage of South African police using brutal paramilitary tactics, beating even the youngest of children, beamed around the world.
As the children rioted, they were ambushed
and sparked international outrage and calls for an end to apartheid.
Now is the time for celebration, for South Africans to join together to celebrate the birth of democracy.
And that's what they did. Jubilant South Africans.
When liberation came with the first all-race elections in South Africa in 1994, the police were going to be reformed, along with everything else, housing, schooling, industries where the best jobs were reserved exclusively for whites. A quarter century later, what's changed? Black South Africans have risen in the ranks. The chain of command is transformed, with black people setting policy, supervising training, overseeing the way police are deployed on the country's streets, and yet, South Africa remains one of the most unequal and violent countries in the world. Complaints persist about the police, including charges of rape, torture, and murder. The situation has worsened under the coronavirus lockdown.
The enforcement of the lockdown is anything but systematic. It appears random.
On April 10th, soldiers from the National Police Force entered the home of Collins Khosa. They accused the 40-year-old father of violating shelter-in-place orders by drinking a beer in his yard. Four policemen beat Khosa with a rifle in front of his family. He died from his injuries a few hours after the police left. At least 10 South Africans, all black, have been killed in police action over the past 3 months. Is the brutality of today's South African police forces a direct descendant of the tactics used during apartheid, even after the entire political and governmental order of the country's been changed? Stan Henkeman joins me. He's the executive director of the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation in South Africa. Stan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Ray.
And John Steinberg teaches African studies at Oxford University. He's the author of Thin Blue, The Unwritten Rules of Policing South Africa. John Steinberg, welcome to World Affairs.
Hi, good to be with you.
Stan Henkeman, let me start with you. There was so much hope directed toward all these institutions immediately after liberation. But the police, in a lot of ways, haven't changed all that much in the way they do their business. What happened?
Well, I think that we underestimated many things in South Africa at the turn of the new dispensation. And we thought that, you know, changing legislation, changing names from the South African Police to the South African Police Service, we thought that those things, you know, and I say we, I include obviously the leadership and so on, that those things will filter through. But what actually happened was that very little was done in terms of shifting the mindset of policemen and women. And so the brutality that we saw under apartheid kind of abated for a while. But as soon as discontent and difficulties came up, the police had knew no other way to deal with these things. And so the problem is really that at the level of attitudinal change, very little has happened. And there are many other things. The fact that the competence issue is something that is a serious problem within the South African police services. And you have this situation where you have a wonderful constitution, you have very positive and affirmative laws, but in reality, very little has changed in the way police do their business and conduct themselves. And I think therein lies the big problem, that yes, we've changed the faces of the leadership, but we have not changed the attitudes and the behavior of the police men and women.
Johnny Steinberg, as a reporter, as a scholar, you've ridden along with the police, you've looked closely at how they do their work. Is there much difference to what happens on the street in a big city, in a rural area, when the police arrive to figure out a situation?
Some things have changed, but not enough. And ironically, one of the reasons why things haven't changed enough is one of the great influences on the South African police during and after the transition to democracy was probably the very worst of American policing. You know, this was the 1990s when Bill Bratton was famously running New York, zero tolerance policing, hotspot policing. In South Africa, there were two imperatives to try and straddle. And the one was some sort of reconciliation between police officers and ordinary South Africans. But the other was a very high rate of crime. And that high rate of crime was a burning, difficult political issue. And probably the judgment of the first democratic government was that fighting crime and reconciliation were in a zero-sum relationship, and they had to fight crime. And they took a very, very tough policing model from abroad, from the United States, in fact, among other places. And it connected in very unfortunate ways with the history of apartheid policing. You know, the pinnacle of apartheid policing was to gather police officers in large formations and throw them at communities paramilitary style. And that remained the core of policing in the late 90s. It had new names. It was called hotspot policing. It was called CompStat. It was driven by figures. Ironically, it had American names, but at its core, it was an old-style South African policing. Part of the problem is that South Africa had this enormous centralized policing bureaucracy. You know, in the United States, you have a decentralized police service. We have one huge national service. Really, it followed a bureaucratic imperative in the late 90s. It did what it could do. It threw itself at the population. It was in its DNA. That's how it did things, and it carried on doing things that way.
Stan Henkemann, does that sound right to you? Not very much changed in the tactics, the way that a policeman was trained to deal with the public?
Absolutely. I think South Africa's, you know, struggling with not just in policing, but in a lot of other spheres of our country and how people live their lives, is a big disconnect between policy and practice. And so if you look, for instance, at policies, you know, they look very good on paper. They look very progressive, but nothing has changed for most South Africans in terms of how the police deal with them and how they experience police. And just growing up, you know, on the Cape Flats, which is an impoverished part of Cape Town, you know, I remember as a child, you know, the relationship we had with police, that when you see a police van, you run because they're not there to protect you. They were there to brutalize you. And dare I say that is still the experience of poor people in the townships on the Cape Flats, where the police is not seen as allies, but actually as enemies.
Johnny Steinberg, that's the trap that it sounds like poor people fall into in a lot of places in the world. That in the neighborhoods that might crave good police work most of all, just to preserve life and limb and property, you want the police to be your ally. And here you are, from Stan's telling, afraid of them when you see them on the street, afraid to call them when there's trouble.
Yeah, you know, you have this situation in South Africa where the country went into lockdown at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the poor really catapulted back into the 1960s in terms of their relationship with police. Poor communities were locked down. There was an effective military occupation. People were not allowed out. And deaths began happening. You mentioned the death of Collins Khoza on Good Friday. Directly after that, George Floyd was killed, and that was all over the media. That was ubiquitous. And that did not generate, it generated a small outcry, but it did not generate mass protest. And there's this puzzle. South Africans can protest and get angry against many things, but not against their police. There's almost a forlorn inevitability about this going on and on and on.
I want to dig a little deeper into that idea of importing methods and techniques from the United States. You know, we were in this country experiencing very high rates of violent crime at the end of the 1980s and the early 1990s as well. And just as a matter of politics and policing, I think a lot of communities were ready to give the police free rein, that it was a terrible situation, so police needed to get tough. And there was a loosening of the idea of civilian control, a loosening of the idea that you really needed to keep a close eye on the police. Was that part of the spirit that greeted this new American set of techniques and ideas after liberation? Johnny?
That is definitely part of what was going on. You know, a transition to democracy is such a complicated business. On the one hand, there's a huge surge of hope, you know, the future opening up. On the other hand, there's great, great uncertainty and great fear about what is going to happen next. And South Africa's transition to democracy was called peaceful, but many thousands of people actually died in political violence. And when the new democratic government came to power, it wanted to be seen as restoring order quickly and decisively. It greatly feared that people would not trust its capacity to run the country. And so it was very attractive. It had a police force of 150,000 people that could be mobilized, that was visible, that could be thrown at people in large numbers. And so when it went out into the world to look for ideas to import, it was very attracted to precisely those very, very hardcore ideas about battening down on crime, about flooding hotspots with troops, about stop and search. That became an enormously popular South African phenomenon in the late 90s for precisely the reasons that you're suggesting. And oddly enough, ironically enough, when surveys were done in poor communities in the late 1990s, a lot of people, especially a lot of older people, and especially a lot of older women, welcomed this very heavy-handed policing and said that they'd made them feel comfortable, that they would tolerate incursions into their homes, that they needed this authoritative force in their life. So I think that the way ordinary people responded to harsh policing was in itself very complex and often quite contradictory.
Stan, how does that look right down at ground level in a place like Alexandra Township, for instance?
No, it's a very interesting phenomenon. We run a survey every 2 years. It's called the South African Reconciliation Barometer. And one of the questions we ask is around policing, levels of trust and confidence in the police. The level of confidence in the police has actually risen over the last number of years. And I think it has to do with the fact that people who regard themselves as law-abiding, you know, are looking for a stronger response from police, because the argument is that the troublemakers and the criminals are in the minority, but because they show more aggression, you know, they get the limelight. And so that is quite an interesting phenomenon. And I think it's really important to understand that for people who find themselves in marginalized settings, you know, the basic things are what they want to be in place, you know, transport, housing, and safety. And safety is a massive problem in South Africa. Even in modern day South Africa, the allocation of resources in terms of policemen to different police stations is still unequal. So you find that in affluent areas, you know, they are better resourced than the poorer communities, where you actually have the majority of people. And yet, in spite of that, the confidence levels of people in the police seem to be rising. And that is one of the interesting things, because the police have really become quite brutal in the way they deal with people. And yet there's a welcoming of a stronger approach to policing, particularly in poor areas.
Right around the time of liberation, word was coming out of what the police had been up to over the past 20 years. In the early 90s, I interviewed Dirk Kotzia, who was willing to talk about methods and techniques for eliminating political opponents, making them disappear, destroying their bodies, targeting them late night. He was part of a unit, a death squad, that ran out of a farm near Pretoria. It was stunning. When we found out what South African police had been up to, why wasn't the first demand that the entire thing be rebuilt from the ground up?
Okay.
Johnny, go ahead.
You know, I can add another puzzle to that. The first democratic legislature in South Africa, if you counted how many people in that legislature had been locked up in prison by the apartheid regime, it was a very, very significant minority. And one of the first pieces of legislation that new parliament passed was to increase minimum mandatory sentences for a raft of crimes, with the results that within 5 years of democracy, the prisons were fuller than they ever were under apartheid. So a lot of these strange dissonances abound. You know, the country is full of them. And part of the mystery is what happens in the transition from being a liberation movement to governing, and what happens to ordinary people in the transition for living under an oppressed regime to a democracy which at first seems unstable.
If I could come in here, I think that we must not underestimate, you know, the difficulty that most of us didn't appreciate around the transition. You know, there were many things that were negotiated at the time between the then regime and the liberation movements. And I think that part of the problem was that there had to be some measure of continuity so that you don't have a complete collapse of systems. And so the fact that the democratic government looked elsewhere for other alternatives, I think was kind of an attempt, you know, to shift away from the past. But you're absolutely right, Ray, that the people who perpetrated these deeds, was most of them were still around. And I think the problem that we have is that, you know, so many sacrifices were made. And when let's talk about police, you know, going outside, I must also say that they also flirted with the community policing concept, you know, from Great Britain. And I remember the British funded the project where they brought some British policemen out to kind of train policemen and women in community policing, visible policing. But, you know, those attempts were really not successful, because going for this hard approach, you know, kind of suited the training that these guys had, you know, whether they're white or black. And so that explains why there was a preference for the harder approach to policing.
On criminality, yes, but there's also a legacy of violence toward the people, the rank and file people of South Africa, on the part of the police. And it seems like, well, I mean, when you pick up the paper and read about trade unionists being shot down during a strikers' march, when you read about people being taken into custody and killed, that some of the habits of how to do this job haven't changed, even 25 years after liberation. Stan?
The systemic interventions in terms of policies, you know, as progressive as they seem, did not do the trick. It doesn't matter, you know, what laws you put in place. Unless you deal with the attitudes and the mindsets and the worldviews of these policemen and women, unless that shifts, you're not going to get any movement. And I guess that's where training is important. You know, if you look at how long it takes to train a policeman in South Africa, it's ridiculous. You know, conflict resolution gets done in one or two lectures. And that's the extent of your training. What about conflict analysis? You know, policemen and women are unable to really read situations properly. They only know one way of responding. And if we're going to shift that, then part of the training, particularly softer skills, should be outsourced. And that is one thing that we certainly feel very strongly about.
South Africa had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The people gave their testimony, talked about what happened in the past in order to get it all out on the record, and in return, were not prosecuted for the crimes they committed under apartheid. Did that work out for the country? Was it so important to know some of these things that it was worth not punishing people for their crimes as compensation to find out the truth?
Well, it wasn't that simple. You know, there was a amnesty committee of the TRC, and they operated like a court of law, and people had to do full disclosures. Whatever they wanted amnesty for had to have had a political motive, and then, you know, whatever they did had to be in proportion to what it is they, you know, one would expect in a situation like that. I think the idea was that it's okay to give people amnesty. But what happens if you don't get amnesty? And that is where I think the system failed people, because over 5,000 people who didn't receive amnesty were never prosecuted. It's a lesson I think other countries can learn from it, from us. And that is, if you don't want a commission like this to be a whitewash, then make sure that there is the political will to follow through on the recommendations. It has to do with the criminal justice system and the political will. And again, we suspect that there were deals made behind the scenes and around the negotiating table, which average people like myself don't know about. But the people feel it down. The people feel that, and I think that also adds to the sense of let's do what we want, because in this country you can get away with these heinous things and nothing will happen to you.
Johnny Steinberg, same question. And do the lessons of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission have some applicability in a country like mine, still trying to wrestle with the legacy of police behavior in the past?
Well, first, just to agree with everything Stan has said, and to briefly add that without the Truth Commission, there would not have been a peaceful settlement in South Africa. It was... amnesty on some terms was a condition of peace. The alternative was civil war. And to ask for the full truth in exchange for amnesty, I think, was the best that could be done under the circumstances. This was good. I should also say that the settlement itself created great opportunity for change, including for economic justice. And if those opportunities were not taken, it's not the fault of those who wrote the new constitution or the Truth Commission. It's the fault of those who followed. And we tend to forget that in South Africa. We blame the founders for everything that happened after the founding, which is not right. A Truth Commission in the United States, absolutely, as long as it is accompanied by genuine and lasting reform, and as long as it underpins that reform and gives it momentum and makes that possible, a truly horrific situation is to go through some sort of truth-telling process connected to amnesty and then not enough changes. That leaves the sort of business that Stan has been talking about.
Johnny, I'm sure you've been following events in the United States. Demonstrators from Seattle to Miami have been chanting, defund the police. They want to just blow up the whole system. And in many cases, not even start from scratch. Have much less in the way of policing resources in the cities of this country. Is there any parallel in South Africa? Is this a sort of natural response to suffering at the hands of police?
Well, you know, I think South Africans can only look on with some envy, because in what's happening in the United States is a powerful grassroots mass accumulation of real feeling. And that's where change comes from. And more than that, Black Lives Matter and associated movements have been thinking in quite deep and sophisticated ways about policing. And so you have a real popular propulsion backed by quite deep thought about what alternatives are. And I think that is enormously hopeful. In South Africa, you really had none of that. You know, the reform was top down, implemented by an elite. There was very little mass pressure for it. There was very little civil society organization around it. And frankly, the elite lost interest in reform when it stopped mattering enough politically, precisely because there was little pressure from the ground. So I would say that police reform in the United States right now has much more chance, much more opportunity for creativity and real change than, unfortunately, we've had in South Africa.
Stan, earlier you talked about being a kid running away from the police, or at least wanting to be scarce when they were around. Well, now you're a grown-up man. Are you relieved when a police vehicle rolls up? Are you wary? I mean, has this changed over the course of your adult life?
I'm not relieved, but I am wary, because the bottom line is I don't know what to expect. And at least at this point in my life, I'm able to speak for myself. I'm able to I know my rights, because, you know, in the midst of all of this, we live in a society where human rights are at least in principle upheld. And so yes, I don't feel scared, but at the same time, I don't have confidence that the outcome of any interaction with the police would be completely in my favor, because you just don't know what to expect. And that has to do with the quality of police men and women, but also, you know, some of them really have a serious problem with aggression and anger, and that gets manifested in the way they deal with people.
Stan Henkemann is the executive director of the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation in South Africa, and joined us from South Africa. Johnny Steinberg is a lecturer at Oxford in the African Studies Center. His latest book is A Man of Good Hope, recording the life history of a Somali man who flees Mogadishu and settles in South Africa. Johnny Steinberg, great to have you with us.
Thanks so much.
Stan Henkemann, great to have you with us on World Affairs. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to World Affairs. We just heard Ray Suarez in conversation with Stan Henkemann, the executive director of the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation in South Africa. He joined John Steinberg, who teaches African Studies at Oxford University. Both discuss South Africa's ongoing struggle with police reform. To hear this program or any other episode, you can download our podcasts on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. While you're there, please leave us a rating. It helps others find our program. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from Chevron. This program was produced and reported by Teresa Katsourilis. It was edited by Joanne Jennings, our executive producer. It was mixed and mastered by Jared Sport. He's also our senior producer. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett, Allegra Diamond, Hannah Harasaki, Julia Kwasnitsa, Catherine Putz, and Tatum Sanderbeck provided research assistance. I'm Philip Young. Thanks for listening.